So go ahead and open up to Matthew 27. And as we consider the context, we remind you of a few of the things that we've seen so far. This passage would, I mean, you could read it through in just several minutes. And it, obviously, in the course of time, it wasn't that much longer. I mean, they were talking several hours, beginning with the Passover dinner, the Last Supper, and the betrayal and his arrest and trial before the Sanhedrin, and now his trial before Pilate, stands trial before Rome. We know that this is where Jesus has been heading. He has informed us of such a thing, and he has told his disciples of what would happen to him, that he would be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes, that they will condemn him to death, and we've seen all of this take place. Betrayed by one of his own disciples, abandoned by all the other disciples, denied by his closest disciple, falsely accused by his own people, and ultimately condemned by them for blasphemy. All of that we've seen. We should have been anticipating it, expecting it. That's what Jesus has said is going to happen. And then in several other places, he has spoken about the end of that, that he would then be delivered up to the Gentiles, that he would be delivered up to Rome, who would then deliver him up to crucifixion. So we've reached that point in the narrative. No one can rid themselves of their role in seeing Jesus. Matthew makes it so blatantly clear, the innocent one. No one can rid themselves of the guilt that they have in condemning this innocent man, this righteous man, to death. Not Judas, not the chief priest, and here we even see the people trying, people even accepting their responsibility, their role in seeing Jesus executed. Pilate can't do it no matter how hard he scrubs his hands. All are guilty. All are laid guilty before their execution and condemnation of this innocent man. So this passage then, what we see today, is his trial before Pilate, like I said. And this is the last step before he is crucified. This is the last thing that will happen to him. We know that Rome is the only one who can issue this decree, who can decide in favor of the people or in favor of Jesus. They're the only ones who can actually carry out the capital crime. They can carry out the punishment for that capital crime. They can issue the order to execute, to crucify this man. They're the only ones that can do it. So there's almost this necessity that we see here that Rome has to be involved somehow. It's not just that Jesus predicted it. It's not just that he said it's going to happen this way. It almost of necessity has to happen. This is how he would be pierced. This is how he would be crushed. This is how he would be executed. Rome was the one who would have to give that final order. So it's not just an indictment of the Jews, their role in seeing Jesus, the innocent one, executed. It is really an indictment of everyone, the Gentiles included. Rome had to be involved, and they stand guilty as well. So we know that this is the end, but as the narrative is being told, it doesn't necessarily appear like that is going to be the end. The characters involved in the story are still uncertain about what is going to happen to Jesus. Like, we know what's going to happen. We know the story. We know the details of it. We know the meaning behind it. But the characters here are working this out. They're working it out in terms of what has happened to Jesus and the trial that took place before the Sanhedrin. And even here, you'll see Pilate waver. You'll see him really try to decide for himself what he should do and how he should get out of this, how he can get out of this. And it's really it's amazing display how Pilate, even though he sees the innocence of Jesus, this man does not deserve to die. He sees the wicked, evil motivations of the people and wanting him dead. He even gives them the option. He's going to present them with the option of choosing a wicked, notorious murderer or Jesus as kind of the last final straw. And they, of course, do not pick Jesus and pick Barabbas. So let's work through it. Pretending that we are just a part of the story. Not pretending, I mean, we actually are a part of the story. But as if we were there witnessing all of this take place. So we're actually going to read the first two verses of chapter 27. And then we're going to jump forward to verse 11 and read through verse 26. When morning came, all the chief priests and the elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. And they bound him and led him away and delivered him over to Pilate the governor. Now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus said, "You have said so." But when he was accused by the chief priests and elders, he gave no answer. Then Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear how many things they testify against you?" But he gave him no answer, not even to a single charge, so that the governor was greatly amazed. Now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to release for the crowd any one prisoner whom they wanted. And they had then a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. But when they had gathered, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release for you, Barabbas or Jesus who is called Christ?" For he knew that it was out of envy that they had delivered him up. Besides, while he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent word to him, "Have nothing to do with that righteous man, for I have suffered much because of him today in a dream." And now the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. The governor again said to them, "Which of the two do you want me to release for you?" And they said, "Barabbas." And Pilate said to them, "Then what shall I do with Jesus who is called Christ?" They all said, "Let him be crucified." And he said, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Let him be crucified." So when Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took water and washed his hands before the crowd, saying, "I am innocent of this man's blood. See to it yourselves." And all the people answered, "His blood be on us and on our children." And then he released for them Barabbas, and having scourged Jesus, delivered him to be crucified. So what we see then, initially here with Pilate, that Jesus is standing before him as the King of the Jews. That seems to be what this is ultimately about. Now, I don't know if you noticed it or not. It took me a long time. I think somebody pointed it out to me that what Pilate is described as saying here is really a series of questions. So this is really just a question and answer narrative. He asked, I think, six specific questions, both of Jesus and then of the crowd. And it's really how it carries the story along. He asked these questions, and the issue that is brought to the forefront is this matter of whether or not Jesus is the King of the Jews. So that is where we see Pilate asking Jesus, now that he's standing before him, is he the King of the Jews? This is important for us to recognize. This was kind of assumed from the very beginning about the Sanhedrin, when Jesus stood trial before the religious leaders, the Jewish leaders. And there was a number of false witnesses that we saw being brought before the Sanhedrin, and they were all attempting to come up with some story that they could corroborate and actually accuse Jesus of committing some sort of crime. And we know that that was futile. There was really no progress that was being made in the number of false witnesses that came up before the Sanhedrin. They were lying about Jesus, and yet they couldn't agree on the lies that they wanted to tell. Until finally, two men came up and accused Jesus, twisting his words, accused Jesus of saying that he was going to destroy this temple and then rebuild it in 3 days. Well, that accusation was quickly dismissed by the high priest. Didn't even build his case upon it. And then he accused him of being the Son of Man. "Are you the Christ? Are you the Messiah? Tell us plainly, we want to know." And that's where we see Jesus speak up the most that we see him speak in this last few hours of his life. And he tells them that most definitely he is the Son of Man. He is the one who will be seated at God's right hand. He is the one who will come on the clouds of heaven and receive an eternal dominion. He will receive a kingdom that will last forever. And that was what caused the high priest to proclaim blasphemy. Jesus claims kingship, The high priest knew it and understood it, and that is the accusation that then is laid at Pilate's feet. Here is one who claims to be the king of the Jews. Here is one who claims to be the Messiah. Now we know that all the other details around this, Pilate would not care about. This is not a religious question for Pilate. This is not something that he is debating and wondering if maybe here is the Messiah that he has looked for. He has no Messiah. He worships a multitude of different gods. He is not evaluating this on some sort of religious basis. He doesn't care about the Old Testament scriptures. He doesn't care about what Yahweh had promised. He doesn't care about a suffering servant or atonement for sins. He doesn't care about any of that. What he cares about is purely political. And you can read the other narratives in John and Mark, and you can see how they contribute to this dialogue between Pilate and Jesus. And Pilate's concern is about the revolutionary nature of Jesus' kingship. Is he a king like the other false messiahs that we've seen and we've experienced? Is he going to lead a revolution against us and seek to overthrow our rule? Is he going to attack Rome? That's all that Pilate is thinking about. That's all that concerns him. So when we see his question, "Are you the king of the Jews?" that is what he is thinking. And of course, we know what the Jewish people were thinking. They were looking for that type of political savior. They were looking for that type of Messiah, one who would deliver them from the oppression that Rome has placed upon them, the one who would lead them out from slavery, one who would lead them in glorious revolution over the powers of the nations, one who would wield the sword and overthrow their rulers. That is underlying the Jewish assumption of what Jesus is claiming. That is probably the reason why they are rejecting him, because he does not appear to be that type of Messiah. So that is what Pilate is thinking. He knows that this is a serious claim, has incredible significance for his role in Palestine, in the land of Judea, as the Roman governor, Roman representative, the highest ruling Roman authority in Judea, here on behalf of Caesar himself. He knows that his rule is under threat by this type of claim. If Jesus is claiming to be a king, then he knows where that can lead. In fact, he has people that are already in prison awaiting execution on that very basis. Not necessarily being false messiahs, but being zealots, being revolutionaries. The one that gets named here specifically is the notorious Barabbas. So that is a question that Pilate poses to Jesus. And Jesus, not surprisingly, he answers in that weird affirmative type of way, basically saying, "You say so." Not denying the fact that he is king. Right? Not denying it, but not also giving that straightforward, clear answer. He is affirming it, but he's affirming it in a way that gives him an out, that lets him define for himself what that really means. You say that I am a king, you say the right thing. The same way in which he responded to Judas, when Judas asked him if he was going to be the one who would betray him. I think you remember that. The same way that he responds to the high priest, when the high priest asks him if he is the Messiah, the Son of God. A very succinct way of affirming these answers. So Jesus is not dodging the question at all. He's not avoiding it, but he is not launching a full-fledged defense. He is not getting into arguments about why he is innocent. And actually, when we see in the narrative here that these are the last words that Jesus speaks until he cries out on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me?" That's it. From here until there, he is completely silent. No words, no defense. No arguments. He goes in obedience to his Father's will. I think that silence actually speaks volumes. That silence speaks louder than the crowds. The crowds who are shouting for Jesus to be crucified, Jesus' silence speaks louder than that. And you may ask, why is it that Jesus stands silent? What actually is interesting, if you look at the Roman procedures for accusing a criminal and evaluating a case like this, silence would automatically, in the Roman mind, determine that you are guilty. You have no defense. You are not, in fact, innocent. So for Jesus to actually not defend himself would, in Pilate's mind, actually demonstrate that he is guilty, that he deserves to be executed for his crimes, crimes of claiming to be a king. But that's what makes it so astounding, is that Pilate, in a number of ways, sees that Jesus is completely innocent, even though he doesn't defend himself. So Jesus speaks through his silence. His very demeanor demonstrates that he is innocent. And Grant Osborne called it a majestic dignity. Here he is, standing before the highest authority in the land, being brought and presented before him because his own people have rejected him as Messiah, as king. And here he is in silence before his accusers who are launching attack after attack upon him, before the crowds who are clamoring and shouting for him to be killed, and before Pilate, the one who can actually issue this death sentence. And he stands in his majestic dignity, no defense, just steadfast, calm, at peace, and everything else is clamoring around him. You can see the beauty, really, of our Savior. We can see that not only does he demonstrate this incredible amount of fortitude, we see that this is exactly what the prophets have spoken of. You can't read this without thinking about Isaiah 53. That he was oppressed, he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opens not his mouth. Again, why does he not defend himself? We know that he could have called, 10,000 legions of angels? We know that he had them at his very call, that if he simply cried out to his Father, then he would have a number of these created spiritual beings that would come to his defense and rescue him from this situation. We know that his Father is listening to him as he cried and prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane. So why not just simply give some defense? He could have completely cut them down. Every time they tried to trap him, every time they tried to ensnare him in these questions that they would pose to him, he simply demolished them very quickly, with no effort, it seemed, at all. So why not defend? There may be a time when you do not respond to the evil accusations that are launched against you. As far as we can see, this is a case in which that takes place. Evil may be launched against you, and there may be a time that you just simply have to withstand it. That there's no reason for you to stand up and defend yourself. There's no reason to offer an alternative perspective. There's no reason to correct those who are simply bent by an evil desire to see you accused, falsely maligned. What good would it really do? What good would it do to defend yourself before people who are fixated on seeing your bloodshed, right? What good would it do to stand before the most powerful court, knowing that they are going to be corrupted and twisted by the crowds, that the mob rule is actually going to take effect? What good would it do to waste your breath, to cast your pearls before swine, to speak in your defense when there will be no justice and you will not change anyone's mind? There may come a time in which that is the right response. However difficult it may be to withstand responding at all, that may in fact be the right response. But I think there's more than that as well. It's not just the fact that Jesus didn't want to waste his breath. I think Jesus is completely committed to seeing his Father's will take place. He was going to suffer. He was going to be threatened. He was going to be blasphemed himself. He was going to be mocked. He was going to be physically assaulted. And yet he would go silently determined to entrust himself to the one who judges justly. Peter says in 1 Peter 2. Jesus, in his silence, was committing himself not just to carrying out his Father's will, but he was committing himself to his Father, to the true judge, to the one who really was going to execute justice. He was committing himself to him. He was doing so in a way that demonstrates more moral character than we can possibly muster up, knowing exactly what was going to befall him. And this silence, even as Jesus trusted his Father, when everyone else is against him, this silence is amazing to Pilate. You can imagine other situations in which less than high character people like Jesus are brought before Pilate, and he is weighed in, and he has determined the case, heard the accusations and listened to the witnesses and heard the defenses that the accused have brought forth. And you can imagine that they do everything they can to get themselves out of that situation, that they are not going to stand there in silence and just take it. Why would you do that? You're basically consigning yourself to a martyr's death. You know what he has the power to do, and you know what penalty is going to accompany those crimes, and you're not just going to stand there and take it. You're going to try to get out from underneath that. That desire to live is going to lead you to do whatever you can to get out from underneath that accusation. So Jesus doesn't say a word. And in his silence, he's still amazing. He doesn't say anything, and yet Pilate is amazed at the fact that Jesus doesn't defend himself. Against everything that the people were saying, most likely these were the leaders of the Sanhedrin that were bringing these accusations to Pilate. They were twisting these very words and making Jesus seem like a violent revolutionary, a threat to their rule, trying to make it seem that he needed to be killed. And yet Jesus doesn't give any answer. Doesn't give an answer to any charge. Do you not hear how many things they testify against you? He gave him no answer, not even to a single word, so that the governor was greatly amazed. Here we see the light of his steadfast and pure heart and how it exposes all of the evil darkness around him. He stays silent. Now that seems to be the sum and substance of Pilate's interaction with Jesus. Like, he takes, again, the back seat, right? It is now going to be between Pilate and the people. It shifts from this interaction between Pilate and Jesus, which is a very short, condensed version of this. I think the Gospel of John has the longer version of it. And it shifts now to Pilate and the people. And apparently there is a practice, I guess, that was common, at least during that time, common enough for the gospel writers to speak about it, in which the governor would release a criminal during the time of a festival, and he would pardon him. They called it, actually, interestingly, the Paschal amnesty. So here we have an amnesty program in which a convicted criminal would be released to the people. And this was obviously designed to show Rome's grace and Rome's mercy and their desire and their welfare for the people. And you can imagine that there would be no other sort of rulers or governors or leaders who would do such a thing. Now, what makes the practice sound so strange, why would you release a violent criminal into the public? I mean, why would you do something like that? It seems to be in order for the governor to gain the favor of the people. Right? We're doing something that is benefiting you by releasing this violent murderer, insurrectionist, rapist, whatever it might be, back into the public. You could see that rulers, and when power gets to their head, they do really stupid and foolish things. Not that our leaders would ever do anything like that. So that is the practice. And of course, I think this would gain the affection of the crowds. In fact, this is what they want. This is what they're going to ask for. Because in their way, they see these guys as heroes. At least in the case of Barabbas, they probably saw him as one who had more zeal, one who had the revolutionary spirit that they aspired to, one who was willing to take up the sword and try to overthrow the bad guys. And they would probably embrace him. He didn't appear to be a threat to the people. He probably was a threat more to Rome. So that is why we see them eagerly, zealously asking for Barabbas. Before we get there, we have to see how, again, Matthew is showing us, in Pilate's eyes, Jesus is innocent. So the feast, the governor was accustomed to release for the crowd any one prisoner whom they wanted, and they had then a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. So when they had gathered, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release for you, Barabbas, or Jesus who is called Christ?" For he knew that it was out of envy that they had delivered him up. So Pilate hears the accusations. He hears the crowd shouting. He hears these words from the Sanhedrin. And he sees through it all. It's out of envy that they delivered him up. It was out of envy that they wanted him executed. So in his mind, and it's not really a matter of whether or not Jesus is a king, that seems to be superfluous. It's really about this motivation that the leaders had. They wanted the acclaim. They wanted the recognition. They wanted the following that Jesus himself had. Remember, not just several days before this, Jesus rides into Jerusalem and the crowds are hailing him. The crowds are praising him. Here comes the Son of David. Here comes our King. They're surrounding him. They're hailing him. They're close to worshiping him. They're astounded at what Jesus does. They're probably on his side when they're questioning him in the temple precincts. And it was out of that envy that the leaders had that led them to this point. And it's clear if you read through the rest of the Gospel of Matthew, you see that clearly. Jesus was a threat to them. He was a threat to their influence. He was a threat to their power. He was a threat to their authority. He could interpret the scriptures better than them, and he questioned. He was a threat to their traditions. So they wanted him gone, and Pilate sees it. It's not like he could see, maybe he just knew the heart of this people. And if you read some of the historical writings from Josephus or other authors, you see that his relationship with the Jewish people was not very good. He was kind of a tyrant. He kind of provoked them on purpose a number of times. So his rule is really on shaky ground here. And I think that's why we see him, in one way, landing up where he does, giving into the crowds. Whether he just knew their heart or whether he just saw through the false accusations and he was convinced by the demeanor that Jesus displayed, he realizes that their motivation is purely envy. And even beyond that, we see that he himself has been warned by his wife. He was sitting on the judgment seat. His wife sent word to him, "Have nothing to do with that righteous man, for I have suffered much because of him today in a dream." I'm sure that this probably had never happened at any point during his rule. He is here listening in the early morning hours to a case that has been presented before him, a capital crime, a crime against the state, and then his wife sends word about the case and about the criminal that is standing before him. A dream that she had, which we know, according to Matthew, where do dreams come from? They come from God. Go back and read the beginning of the gospel. How many dreams are there? A dream to Joseph, multiple times, a dream to the Magi. Dreams come from God. This was a message that God had given the wife of Pilate to warn him about the righteous man that stood trial before him. about the innocent man. Again, stressing that point. So Pilate had been warned, divinely warned by God through his wife, through a dream, that this man was righteous and that he should simply have nothing to do with it. Just dismiss this case, say that he's not going to be charged. You know, whatever that might have looked like at this point, just get away from this man. You don't want anything to do with condemning this man. So he sees through the motivation of the Jewish people. He's warned by his wife that Jesus is innocent, that he's righteous. And yet he doesn't listen to it. So even though he goes through the motions, washing his hands at the end of the section, we know that he has his part to play. He has his share in the guilt. He was the only one who could pardon him, only one who could release him. But he doesn't do it. So he's been warned. The most feasible option for Pilate to survive condemning an innocent man and to avoid the accusation that would undoubtedly come at him for failing to act in the best interest of Rome is to follow this custom of releasing a prisoner back to the people. Now think about this for a second. What the people could do for Pilate, and maybe this is part of the reason that makes him decide otherwise, is that they could use this against him before Rome, before any of the other Roman leaders. And they could accuse him of not acting in the best interests of Rome. Now, Pilate had the power to, they're presenting Jesus as the man who is a threat to Roman rule. Here is a king. Here is a, perhaps a revolutionary, perhaps a zealot. And if Pilate pardons him, does not prosecute him, does not condemn him, does not crucify him, then the people could use that against Pilate to show that he is not acting in the best interests of Rome, that he is actually acting in his own best interests. Here is a threat to Roman rule. Here is your representative, your governor, who is deciding in the favor of someone who would seek to overthrow Roman rule. So then this practice now of entering and that we're going to look at, this practice of releasing a prisoner is the way in which Pilate can get out of the situation. Again, we're walking through the story as one of the characters. So Pilate is amazed at the silence of Jesus, convinced that he is innocent, even though he doesn't come to his own defense. He sees the envy as the motivation for the people who want to kill Jesus. He's even warned by his wife. And yet he simply does not want to pardon Jesus because that could lead to accusations against him. So the situation then that has been being presented is this opportunity. I can give the people the option of releasing a criminal to them. And I'm going to pick, when I give them the option, I'm going to pick the worst criminal that we have awaiting execution, and I'm going to pit him against Jesus. So this is Pilate's way out. I'll let the people decide. I'll let the people decide for themselves which criminal they want back. And to kind of tilt it in his favor, or tilt it in the favor of Jesus, he's going to pick the worst of them, the worst criminal. So now Barabbas enters the scene. Notorious prisoner Barabbas. So before there was the notorious B.I.G., there's the notorious Barabbas. Now what we know about Barabbas from the other gospel accounts is that he is a thief, a robber, and that he is a murderer who led an insurrection in the city. So here is your classic example of a zealot. Interestingly, that this is what Jesus actually poses to the guys who came to him in the garden when they came to him with swords and sticks. Do you come to me as a thief, as a zealot, as a revolutionary? You come to arrest me like that? So here is the true revolutionary. And that's what makes this so ironic. This is what they're accusing Jesus of, and yet this is the guy that they have locked up, waiting to be condemned, waiting to be executed, and this is the guy that they pick. So Barabbas, the violent revolutionary, or Jesus. Now, these are the options that Pilate presents before the people. Do you want Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ? Do you want the murderer or the Messiah? Do you want the one who takes life or the one who gives it? Do you want the one who takes the lives of others or the one who lays down his life for others? Do you want the guilty? He's condemned. Or the innocent, the unrighteous or the righteous? Who do you want back? So the leaders then work the crowds. The options are given, and the leaders are there influencing the crowds to choose Barabbas and to destroy Jesus. You see that, I think, in verse 20. The chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. So here they are, having the influence that they want. What is it that they're influencing the people to? Choose a violent criminal instead of the righteous, innocent Jesus, the true Messiah. This does show you, for one, it shows you that the crowds who had up until this time kind of been neutral, kind of been in favor of Jesus, but the crowds here being influenced by their leaders. The leaders are leading them astray, wanting them to pick the guilty man instead of the innocent one. This is their envy at work. They can't stand the fact that the crowds are, that Jesus has the favor of the crowds, that he has the influence, so they influence them for evil purposes. And it seems to work. They stir him up into a frenzy, enticing them to chant, to shout for Barabbas. They persuade the crowds to ask Barabbas and destroy Jesus. They're so determined to see Jesus destroyed, and they seek to persuade others to join their side. So here are people who are fixated on seeing blood, seeing the innocent one shed his blood, seeing the blood of Jesus poured out. Here they are wanting to see him executed. So then Pilate gives them another chance. Who do you want me? Which of the two do you want me to release for you? And they said, Barabbas. And what shall I do with Jesus, who is called Christ? And they all said, let him be crucified. And he said, why? What evil has he done? Again, seeing Pilate sees him as innocent. But they all shouted all the more, let him be crucified. That is their cry. That is their cry to kill the Son of God. Execute the son of Abraham, the son of David, the promised seed, the promised offspring, the righteous one, the holy one, the author of life. This is who they want to kill. And as we read and we see, as we sing, we understand the darkness that is taking place here. We understand that true nature of sin. The true rebellion that resides in every single human heart, every man that has been born in Adam. Rebellion against their creator and their maker, against their king, their ruler. They want bloodshed. To have the opportunity to kill God, and they take it. They want to see him executed. So that's a way in which we can see our part in this as well, right? We are no different than them. On our own, apart from the Spirit of God, apart from his grace towards us, we're no different. We would have not done anything differently. And yet they are so blinded by their sinfulness and by their guilt that they simply cry out, let him be crucified. Nail him to the cross. Hang him on the tree. The very cries of which will lead them when judgment befalls them for this heinous act, shedding the innocent blood of the Son of God. lead them to cry out for the rocks to fall on them. See that in Luke 21 and Revelation 6. The wrath of God comes upon them and they cry out for the rocks to fall upon them and crush them. So it is this cry that leads to that one. And this cry that ultimately leads Pilate to the choice that he must make. Before we go there, I think there's another layer here that we can see some depth to this. And this is pretty astonishing. The significance of the choice that Pilate puts before the people, before Jesus or Barabbas. It's not just about the fact that one was guilty and one was innocent. One was the murderer and one was the Messiah. One was unrighteous and one was righteous. It's this whole concept of the name of this criminal. Why is the name given? Not just because he's notorious. Interesting here, the name, following the custom here, remember how Peter is named Simon Bar-Jonah, Simon son of Jonah. Here the surname of Barabbas means son of the father, Bar Abba, Abba father, right? So here is this man, this condemned criminal, pitted against Jesus, the innocent one, with the name son of the father. And what's even more interesting is that if you look at some of the ancient manuscripts, they actually describe his name as being Jesus Barabbas. In two cases, in verse 15 and verse 16. So it's really a matter of picking one Jesus or the other. Jesus meaning God saves. Christ, of course, meaning Messiah. And you see that distinction that I think Pilate is making in verse 17. Do you want me to release Barabbas, Jesus Barabbas, or Jesus Christ? So it's almost as if Matthew wants to see it as this choice that is being presented to the people on which Jesus they want. Do they want the one? Do they want the one who is going to save them by the sword? Do they want the murderous revolutionary? Or do they want the one who is going to save them by the cross? Which Jesus do you want? Which son of the Father do you want? So they have to pick, really, between two different ways of salvation. And what is it that they pick? Give me the violent one. Give me the murderer. Release him to us. He is one of us. He is our people. He is the one that we are going to follow. We are going to follow in his footsteps. And if they take that sword up, they will die by that sword. So in a way, they're showing the direction that they're going. These bloodthirsty people, shedding innocent blood, are going to take up the sword, rebel against Rome, and then within a generation, they will face the sword. The sword that Rome wields is a bigger, stronger, sharper sword. And they're going to wield it in a far better, more efficient way, and it's going to come crashing down upon these people. And they don't even see it. This has been what Jesus has warned them about. It was the warning that he gave them at the end of chapter 23. The warning that he gave his disciples that they cannot take the sword up in his defense and in following him. That if you do that, you're doomed to die. So that is then the option that that Pilate presents to the people. Interesting to see that this is so important, you know, in the gospel testimony that it actually shows up in the apostolic preaching of the gospel just several years later. Even several days later when Peter preaches, right? Speaking about the innocence of Jesus. You delivered him over and denied him in the presence of Pilate when he had decided to release him. But you deny the holy and righteous one and ask for a murderer to be granted to you, and you killed the author of life whom God raised from the dead. Now think of that when, of course, at that time they were still hardened in their sins. But think of that. The rulers are still in opposition to the apostles at that time. But think of that accusation being brought against you. You will see your guilt being confronted with it face on. All of that wicked motivation that you had. All of that bloodshed that you couldn't see past. And it brought before you. You killed the author of life. And yet God raised him up and made him king. God raised him up and seated him at his right hand. There would be no hope for you. And that is what Judas experiences in shedding the blood of the innocent Jesus. He had no hope. He didn't know the gospel. And yet, that is the accusation that Peter lands at the feet of the people. You killed him by the hands of lawless men. You killed him. You murdered him. And God raised him up. The only way, the only possible way you can escape from that guilt is by the very blood of Jesus whom you shed. By the very blood of the one that you killed. You can't make this up. This doesn't make any sense apart from God's revelation. All right, so let's look at this last section, though. The option has been presented to the people. And he doesn't get the results that he wanted. He had wanted Jesus, the crowd to pick Jesus, right? This is the whole motivation behind it. This is what he wants. This is how he wants it to go. And even kind of intimates that in 24 when Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing. His plan is not going to work. He's so afraid of losing the favor of the people. He's so afraid of what the riots can do and how that would be communicated to Caesar. He wants to save his own skin. He wants to save his career, which ironically only lasted for another 5 years. So he gives in to the angry mob. Now, as a leader, never listen to the angry mob. You can understand all the temptation, right? All of the threats and all of the emails that they send and all of the rioting and protests. They're pretty loud. Violent even. But we know that usually with an angry mob, there's never any sort of true justice. This is not what's going to actually end up in a good situation. A very powerful political motivator, though. The squeaky wheel gets the grease. The angry mobs get their way. So in the end, Pilate caves. And just to make it extremely clear to the people that he has no hand in this, that he has no part to play in this, he follows through with this strangely symbolic act. He pretends to wash his guilt away. Right? He's going to absolve himself of his role in executing an innocent man. So he caves to the people, and then he washes his hands. Now, it's interesting here. There doesn't seem to be a Roman practice that is established. We don't know where Pilate got this symbolism. We don't know where Pilate got this act. We don't know exactly what motivated him to do this. We know it was his desire to apparently show himself to be cleansed of this man's blood, that he really has no part in the decision that's being made, even though he's the only one that can make the decision. He's the only one who can give the order. He's saying, I don't have anything to do with it. So, there is Old Testament precedence, though, for the washing of hands. And obviously, it's symbolic, then, of being innocent. Interesting that in Deuteronomy, which we just read in the Bible reading plan, there's this practice of establishing guilt on the basis of an unsolved murder. So if somebody happened across a murdered body, what the leaders would do is that they would determine like which city is closest to this murdered body, and they would call the leaders of that city, and they would bring a heifer, they would bring a sacrifice, and they would wash their hands over the sacrifice. The leaders would say, basically, in essence, that we have no part to play in the murder of this innocent person, that we have not shed the innocent blood, We have not shed this person's blood, and we wash our hands to show that we are innocent, that there is no guilt that is attached to us. And then atonement is made through the sacrifice for that innocent blood. So this is a situation in which, of course, some sort of murder takes place, and there's no witnesses, so there can be no trial, but still atonement has to be made. You can read that in Deuteronomy chapter 21. So Pilate, even though he probably wasn't aware of that practice, he actually follows through on something that seems to be similar. He knows that this is an innocent man. He knows that he's going to give the order for him to be executed, as he's the only one that can do it. And yet he doesn't want any part in it. So he follows through on this act of washing his hands to make it seem as if he is guiltless. He's innocent. He's just as innocent as Jesus is. Now, what is shocking and chilling is what the people say in verse 25. All the people answered, "His blood be on us and on our children." So Pilate, every step of the way, has been trying to avoid his hand, his guilt in condemning Jesus to die. Trying to get away from that. Anything that he can think of, he's trying to avoid. And then, on the other hand, what do the people want? The people want full responsibility. They want his blood to be upon them and upon their children. Not knowing at all what they are even doing. The blood of Jesus is going to stain them. It will call down God's righteous wrath and judgment upon them. And yet they cry out for it. They cry out for his blood to be upon them. Not just them, but their children, their offspring. A verse that's been abused throughout church history in anti-Semitic acts. Seeing then that the people themselves are asking to be cursed for shedding this innocent blood. A very chilling, probably the saddest verse in all of Scripture. And of course, that's what they get. They can't escape the guilt from it either. It's not as if God is going to put the blood on other people. But this is it. This is the culmination of thousands of years of rebellion, of breaking the covenants, of worshiping other gods. Here the Son has come. Thinking of the parable of the vineyard owner, which God had sent his servants to the people, and they had stoned them and beat them and killed them, and then thinking that God is going to now send his son, and they will respect his son, and the son comes, and they say, "This is the heir. This is the one who's going to inherit everything. Let's take him out, and we're going to get the vineyard for ourselves." And that's what they do. They do it. And the response that God will have to them who take out the Son is what? He's going to come and destroy their city. He's going to take the vineyard and he's going to give it to different people, to a different nation, one that's going to produce the fruits of it. So we can see then the end of this people when the blood of innocent Abel crying out from the ground for justice is going to be poured out upon them. The blood from Abel all the way to the blood of the innocent Son of God, the righteous one. The one that they placed on that cross that was reserved for Barabbas. The one in which he was crucified right between the other thieves, identifying with them. The blood of that innocent, righteous man is going to be poured out upon this people. They will face the judgment. And the only way for them to escape, the only way for them to be clean is for that blood to clean them. It's the only way out. So So they don't dodge responsibility for killing Jesus. They accept that. And yet he becomes their only hope. He's the only one that can save them. So here is Jesus. The one in verse 26, Barabbas is released. Jesus is scourged. He is whipped. And he is delivered up to be crucified. Last time of the 15 times we've seen that in this section, Pilate now, even though he washes hands, he delivers him up to be crucified. Jesus is headed to the cross. Crucify him. Nail him to the tree. So everyone has played their part. From the disciples, to the leaders, to the people, to Pilate. Everyone bears their guilt. Everyone is involved. Everyone has their part to play. The moment in which humanity has been at its worst, condemning the God who has created them and who sustains them with his very word, who keeps them, who has given them life, they kill him, execute him. But we should see not just the fact that they have their way in murdering the innocent one, but we should see ultimately God's plan. It's Octavius Winslow who says that it wasn't ultimately Judas who betrayed Jesus for money, or Pilate who delivered Jesus up for fear, or the Jews who delivered him up for envy, but it was the Father who gave his only Son out of love. So why such a stress on Jesus' innocence? Not just to show us the faults of those here, not just to show us that everyone is guilty, but to show us that he is the one and only sacrifice for sins. How is it that Jesus' blood can cleanse a guilty sinner? Because he's innocent. Because he's righteous. Matthew's making that point that we see so much clearer, I think, in the epistles and the rest of the New Testament, that here is a sacrifice that can finally atone for sins, that can finally cleanse sinners for all time. Any sin. All of your sins. Here is the blood of the innocent one. The innocent one who takes the place of the guilty. The righteous one who takes the place of the unrighteous. And Barabbas must have known this better than anybody else. Because as he saw this man killed in just several hours, and he walked in freedom, he understood what substitution meant. That he should have died on that cross. That he should have been nailed to that tree with his buddies. That he should have been placed under the curse of God with his friends that he led in revolution. Yet here is the innocent man. Here is the one who took his place. And that's in fact what Jesus has done for all of us. That's what he has done for us. That he shed his blood. That he was cursed so that we could be blessed. That he was cut off from his people so that we could become his people. And this is all a part of God's plan and all demonstrates the abundant love that he has for us, for his enemies. So this is the only way in which we can stand, as Jesus did, silent before the judgment seat of Pilate. This is the only way that we can stand before the judgment seat of God. Now it's interesting that the roles here will be reversed, that even though he stood as the accused victim before Pilate, Jesus is the one who sits on that judgment seat, the bema seat. And he weighs out and he reads the books and sees what's been done in the books, and he weighs out every word and evil thought that's taken place. He's the one who issues the judgment. But yet he's the one who stands in our place and accepts our condemnation. So we see the beauty here. As Dale Bruner says, the wrong Jesus was released, the wrong Jesus scourged, the wrong Jesus crucified, but God used all these wrongs to make everything right. He who did nothing wrong was condemned for everything, so that we who have done everything wrong would be condemned for nothing. beauty of the gospel. Let's pray.